Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of Sangoma, Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation. I am your host, Batabile Mtombeni, mediator and negotiation coach. My guest today is Eileen Rowley. She is a mediator, and we're going to talk about her journey into the world of mediation. We'll also talk about how mediators handle the most intimate issues in their clients' lives. You're listening to a song called Little Voice. It is by Malika Zara, one of my favorite vocalists and composers. She is called the Jewel of Morocco. It is from her latest CD, Berber Taxi. Sit back and enjoy while everyone gathers. We're going to tell you a story. Everybody, welcome to the show, and that was short and sweet there with the introduction. You were listening to Malika Zara, who is, again, as I said, one of my favorite musicians and vocalists, and that was a nice short little piece that gives you an idea of what she sounds like. I'm going to play another piece of hers when we exit the show so that you can get a little bit more of her music. I'm here today with Eileen Rowley, a mediator who is going to talk with me about how she got into mediation, and then we're also going to talk about how mediators handle the intimate issues in their clients' lives and talk about how mediation can help to preserve relationships. So I'm really happy to welcome Eileen to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good. And I'm going to give folks a little bit of a warning. So Eileen let me know that she's been having a little bit of problems with allergies. And as if you've been listening to the show, you know that my saga, I've also had bits of issues with allergies. So we might be clearing our throats a little bit. And I'm telling you this so that I feel more comfortable about it, so that we're all on the same page about what's going on if both of us start hacking all of a sudden. I think we're going to be fine. Eileen, I'm so happy that you chose to come to be a guest here on the show and to talk about how you came into the field of mediation and what it means to you to be a mediator. Tell me a bit about first what you do now as a mediator.
Well, what I do now is I work with folks that are stuck. Usually when my phone rings, it's people that want to unravel their relationship, although there are times when I work with people that want to preserve their relationship. So my role really is to support people where they are and help them work on their agenda as they define it. Another thing that I have in the works right now is I'm training a group of faculty at SUNY New Paltz, the Residence Life Adult faculty, to help give them tips because they find themselves mediating all the time in roommate issues, and sometimes their parents get involved, and they are always looking for tips on how they can do their job better. So in the past, I've trained mediators, I've trained students, and I feel like I have had the benefit of working under a fabulous mentor, John Haynes.
I did read about that, and it's something that when I heard that, I thought, how awesome. Tell me about training under John Haynes.
Well, I first met John when I was heading up the in New York State, the county programs that are funded by the court system. So I was in charge of the counties of Saratoga, Warren, and Washington counties for 12 years. And in that capacity, I had about 66 volunteer mediators that helped provide services. And I met John, and he came in to help train our volunteers. I think over the course of those 12 years, he came three times to do 40-hour divorce mediation trainings for our volunteers.
Now, for people who are listening who perhaps are not familiar with the field of mediation, I think they might be wondering, who's John Haynes and why are we talking about him?
I mean, John Haynes, some people, you know, refer to him as the grandfather of mediation. He passed away about 12 years ago. He lived in Nassau County, and he was very involved in the now defunct Academy of Family Mediators. So there are still disciples of his around, and he had a wonderful approach. And in 96 and 97, when I was involved in, enrolled in the Antioch program, they have a master's in conflict resolution. He was my department chair.
Wow.
So I would call him, and he would, you know, if I had a really sticky case, especially a divorce case, I could call him, and he had the most sage advice. And he was a Quaker, so he brought that to his training and the process. And I, you know, I feel very fortunate to be able to do my work, and he's always with me as I do my work as well.
It's amazing that you mentioned him and that you trained under him. The text that I used in the class, or that we were given in our class to train as divorce mediators, was the book, you know, The Fundamentals of Family Mediation.
Yes, I have.
By John Haynes.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. He absolutely wrote the book.
Yes, he did.
On family mediation and divorce mediation in particular. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about divorce mediation. We're going to get into that, because that's where we talk about folks dealing with the most intimate details of their lives and their relationships, and how mediators help them to mediate, if you would, that process, how to go through the process of dealing with either unraveling the relationships or preserving the relationships. But there's a backstory for you coming into mediation. And what I've heard from you, you know, as we chatted prior, is that there was an experience that you had in your youth that really informs your desire to work as a mediator, and is your inspiration for why you do what you do.
Well, that's true. And to share, I would say that, you know, when I was growing up, it was my brother and me and my mom and dad. My brother is 6 years older than me. And my parents had a family bar and restaurant. We lived in the back. And my maternal grandmother lived with us, and we made all of the food. We had a really nice sort of an Eastern European menu, pierogies and galumpkis and steak sandwiches.
Galumkis
are stuffed cabbages. They're stuffed with rice and ground beef. We had a thriving pizza business. And it was really, really hard work, you know, and as I said, we lived in the back. The thing that was fabulous about it is that we were always surrounded by friends and lots of people, you know, in music. We had a piano, and, you know, we'd be gathered around the piano and, you know, singing songs from, you know, there is a tavern in the town, and the people who came were our friends, and they would bring their family, and you know, sometimes their kids, and my brother and me would sit in the back, and we would play rummy, and we would play war, and my father would put on these fabulous clam bakes, and you know, people would come. We had a big dance hall and a jukebox. It was really lovely. I mean, it was a lot of hard work, but it was also, you know, we were all together. My dad was always there, and the food was great, and the company was wonderful. In the early 70s, my dad, who, you know, loved starting businesses, he had an ice cream, like a soft ice cream and hamburger place. He and his brother lived in northern New Jersey. They went into business together. in the early 70s.
So, I'm sorry, where did you grow up then? What town was
I in? Grew up about 20 miles west of Saratoga Springs in a little rural area, Broad Alban, near the Sacandaga Reservoir. So my dad and his brother in the early 70s, they bought a business together in northern New Jersey. They called it Jersey. It was soft ice cream and hamburgers and things like that. And after several years, things went very bad. And their relationship broke down. And by the virtue of the fact of their relationship breaking down, it also impacted the extended family. You know, it turned out people took sides and they wound up in court. And it was a bad time. And as a result of that experience, I resolved to have family relationships suffer like that in my personal life in any manner that I had any control over. And I really see the value of preserving relationships. And, you know, we all struggle. You know, we all have our troubles. You know, we have our challenges. And it's how we handle them, I think, that, you know, sets us apart. And so for me, I think that is one of the reasons I really connect with the process of mediation, because even though usually when people come, they're stuck, you know, they're there in mediation because they can't figure it out on their own. So it's hard, but it also, by choosing the process of mediation, it helps people get to a better place.
But and kudos for them for coming in the first place. You're talking about your family, and I think that anybody listening can relate in some fashion, understanding, you know, a significant breakdown in relationships of all sorts mm-hmm. that do then wind up in court. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the go-to method for resolving conflict, unfortunately, I think, from my perspective anyway,
yes.
In our culture. But that's mm-hmm. what happened with your family as well. I mean, mm-hmm. it went so far. As a family that was as close-knit as you described it,
mm-hmm.
That really valued togetherness as a family and seemed really mm-hmm. vibrant about that, not being able to, I guess, harness that in order to resolve and heal the rifts that happened in the family, but ended up going to court. I mean, mm-hmm. this is what happens.
Yes. And so experience, you know, is me and helps motivate me in my work by helping support people that show up, my clients, the participants in mediation. And so my goal is always to support them and to help them, you know, support them in making their own decisions as they work through a difficult process.
Now, you talk about preserving relationships in the context of divorce mediation. So what is assumed to be the end result of a divorce mediation is a divorce, a separation, a breaking apart of a marriage. And yet within that, you still have preserving relationship as a goal?
Well, sometimes people who come have children and sometimes they don't. Now, if they do have children, you know, the children could be various ages. And even though they're, as you said, their husband and wife relationship is breaking down, their parenting relationship is evolving and typically is ongoing. So it's supporting that relationship and helping people, you know, acknowledging that, you know, as hard as this is to be in mediation and work through these difficult issues, that they're taking the high road and that, you know, they'll be able to model for their children, their siblings, their friends, their extended family, a process where people can look at them and say, look, these two folks, You know, they are not going to be together, but look how they are going about it. And it also helps them so that they can, you know, when they see one another, maybe occasionally on the street or a family gathering, they can look one another in the eye. They can hold their head up high and they can know that they took the high road and that through a difficult time, they did what they had to do, you know, to work through these difficult issues.
Well, it's easy to say that.
It's hard. It is. It is hard. And I think that's why, you know, when people show up, they need a pat on the back, and they really, you know, we need to talk about, you know, look what you've done, look what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, my personal feeling is that children benefit, you know, when they see their parents, you know, working through a difficult situation and still preserving their relationship to some degree. I think children really benefit from that,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, certainly. They benefit from having parents who are not using them as pawns, who are not using the kids as, you know, part of the power struggle or trying to set the kids up against one parent or the other.
Definitely.
When it comes to actual practice, then, mm-hmm. you know, I know that in my own experience, I've witnessed people who came in feeling tremendously despondent, who were very acrimonious toward each other, go through a transformation over the period of time. And their average of, 8 to 12 sessions in a divorce mediation. Is that what typically happens in your practice?
No, it's usually less.
Oh, good.
It's usually less. But typically what happens, since the parties, the participants, they define how frequent the session is and how long each session is. Typically what happens is the sessions are spread out over a period of time.
Okay.
So I think, you know, typically when people come in, they kind of like have the deal in their head. They've negotiated a little bit. But then, you know, when they come to see me, and I often have a colleague that I work with, so we often co-mediate together, one or two colleagues, depending on what the situation requires, we make sure that there's full disclosure. You know, we back up, we look at all of the financial data. You know, if there are children, we look at what the children need, and we kind of look at all of that information in several different ways. And that takes time. So I would say typically 5 sessions, you know, 3 to 5, 7 sessions might be lengthy. It really depends on what they need. So they really define it. You know, it really depends on how stuck they are.
Oh, it's so different from the typical divorce. That happens with folks who hire lawyers and mm-hmm. so forth. Those can go on for years.
Right. Typically what happens when they work with me is if there's a house, unless they're selling it, it needs to be appraised. If there are pensions, they need to be valued. We really do, you know, pick a date to value everything and then look at all the statements, you know, on that date. And so that goes with the memorandum of understanding. So the judge will have a very good, when the judge signs off on their agreement, the judge will have a very good understanding of, you know, what happened. And we really encourage folks to have an attorney standing in the shadows that they can, in between sessions, you know, they can check in with if there's something comes up, you know, so the process is, the parties themselves, the participants, they're doing all the work, but they're doing it with good legal advice. And typically when people come in, they're not in the same place. You know, emotionally, you mentioned the factor of time. And it's been my experience that time also plays a very important role in how people evolve in their relationship with one another in mediation. So it's a scary process. I mean, usually people, when they come in, there's so much uncertainty that they don't know, you know, exactly what to tell their children because they they don't know the whole story yet either. So when they come, there's a lot of emphasis on collaboration. You know, do you want to sit down and talk with the children together? You know, do you want to formulate a plan together? Do you want to pick out, you know, a realtor together to, you know, do an appraisal? So I think that one of the key concepts in mediation is there's a lot of information and both sides are hearing it and they're sharing it together. And I think that is it not only important, but it's a key element to what happens.
Right. And it's an opportunity for people to perhaps regain a bit of trust if they have lost trust in each other in, you know, sharing this information. And even though they are working toward ending their marital relationship, you know, that process itself can engender or inspire a new kind of relationship between them. And I hesitated like that because I was thinking about a specific case where it was amazing to me that at the end of the mediation sessions that we did, not only did the couple not want to leave, you know, they were saying, wait, we're done? Can't we come back next week? Mm-hmm. You know, really enjoy this time. You help us talk things through and talk really well together. But they felt that they could be friends. They had decided that being married to each other was not good for them, but they still could be cordial with each other. They had young children. Mm-hmm. They were going to be parents to those young children together. Excuse me. And it was really the process that allowed them to develop that new aspect of this relationship.
And what I tell people is it's almost like you're in, you know, a pickup truck and you're driving down the road at night. And it's a little scary, and you can only see so far ahead. Mm. But when you get to the end of the lights, you can see a little bit further.
Yes.
And that's kind of what the process is. One thing that I have seen a trend toward, people that I work with oftentimes think so much of their pets, their dogs, and those issues are often, you know, very important negotiating points. You know, sometimes people don't have children, but they have, you know, they have pets, and that can be an important, and, you know, sometimes they bring them into the mediation. You know, I've had situations where, you know, couples have exchange the pets every other week, and, you know, sometimes they use mediation where, you know,
you mean they actually bring the dog?
They bring,
to the office.
Wow. Right. And you know, there have been several times when I brought my dog in because, you know, there were pet lovers there. And one time the woman for the second session, she called me up. She goes, "We need another session." She said, "And this time we're really going to need the dog."
Oh, that is awesome.
So as I said, I think it's really just supporting people,
right,
you know,
yeah,
for where they are.
Yeah. There's actually a group that just popped up on Facebook. A fellow mediator, a colleague of mine, has put that together. His name is Dennis Owen. And with Sissy, I'm blanking on her last name. I don't want to mispronounce it. I know it starts with an S, Sissy. I'm sorry. But they're talking about pet mediation. In other words, bringing pets in, you know, bringing dogs in and so forth. I mean, it's well understood that, you know, petting an animal can lower your blood pressure and so forth. And so what you're doing is something that other mediators are looking to do as well. And I think that participants who like dogs or like cats can find a benefit from it. So I find it really interesting that you're saying that people are actually requesting, your dog must be pretty good.
Yeah, he is. And another, once again, kind of meeting people where they are, I have a trend towards sometimes phone mediation.
Okay.
Where, you know, maybe one of them might be living in Manhattan and the other one might be in Woodstock, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, it's just not convenient for them both. It really depends. Sometimes the mediation process works more smoothly when they're not in the same room because, you know, a lot of that emotion is gone. You know, some of those triggers are gone. And, you know, sometimes as mediators, we don't really know what the triggers are. But somebody can say the word mother, and then, you know, the other party's, like, neck starts getting red, and they need to take a break. So in some ways it's a minefield, but it's really, as I said, once again, supporting the parties mm-hmm. and helping them, you know, supporting their decisions.
Well, you've just alluded to something that is really the crux of what I wanted to talk about, one of the main issues I wanted us to talk about today, which is what happens when in mediation you start to hear about the more intimate details of a person's relationship mm-hmm. or of a couple's relationship. You know, I know that I joke with or laugh with, you know, other colleagues that we'll be out in public and start talking to somebody and within 5 minutes they're telling us their life story. You know, this seems to be a characteristic that is common to mediators, that we are open and inviting and folks trust us pretty quickly and feel comfortable telling us about things that they might not even talk to a sibling about or, you know, somebody who's a close friend, but they can tell us. So in your practice, I don't know whether this was a surprise to you when you started or, you know, if you've experienced some kind of an evolution about how you handle having people tell you sometimes really difficult things.
Well, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple things I would like to say about that. One is that I have a couple of different settings for folks. If it's a business relationship that may have gone bad or they want to improve it, they might need a more office setting with a round table and chairs. Sometimes folks need a more intimate setting, where, you know, they need soft lighting, you know, have a shag carpet and, you know, very comfortable chairs and, you know, pillows. So once again, it's meeting them where they are. But in either situation, what I tell people is that when they come into the room and we close the door, it's my goal to create a very safe environment so that they can feel like they can talk about anything that they want to and know that it won't be repeated. And in the first session, I acknowledge that it's hard for people to come into a room and sit down with a complete stranger or complete strangers and talk about the most intimate details of their lives. You know, usually it takes, you know, the next session that might happen, but it's more like, you know, kind of finding out who you are and, you know, is this a good fit and, you know, trying it on for size, the process even. And the other thing that I don't do is I don't quiz people on why they're there so they can talk about as much as they want to or they feel they need to. And for example, if people are separating or divorcing, I never ask them, you know, what is the reason mm-hmm. for this?
Mm-hmm.
It usually evolves, you know, it often comes out. But once again, it's about supporting them. And I tell them, you know, if we see one another on the street, which happens more and more often, you know, to make this process work for you, I am not going to acknowledge you unless you come over and put your arm around me and say, hey, Lee, you know, how's it going? That's up to you.
Right.
But my goal is to make them feel as comfortable as possible. So when those intimate, you know, issues need to be talked about, they feel, you know, that they can really do it and that, you know, it won't be repeated anywhere.
Some people might feel uncomfortable with referring to this relationship in religious terms, but there is a way in which I sometimes feel that mediators are secular priests in a way. You know, there is that understanding of confidentiality and that it is, in some ways, some people could call it a sort of sacred trust between the mediator and the people you're mediating with, that not only are you going to keep their secrets, but that you will honor what they share with you in the way that you interact with them,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. Here's something else that I was wondering about, and this has to do with now figuring out specifics of, you know, who's going to get what.
Mm-hmm.
In your practice, what do you find works? If they have to divide up something that is, generally speaking, not divisible. I mean, you talked about the dog, and so the people mm-hmm. who create custody agreements, in a sense, and visitation agreements
mm-hmm.
For the dogs. And what about material things?
Well, sometimes it's hard for the participants to really get how that works
mm-hmm.
in the end, but we do have to create a net worth statement. So I love using food analogies.
Oh.
So if you think about a pie, we put everything into the pie. You know, there's some positive values in there and some negative values, and the entire pie comes up with a number.
Okay.
Okay. And then they decide how they want to split up the pieces. You know, sometimes it's 50-50, sometimes it's 60-40, sometimes it's the ratio is more fractured than that, should I say. You know, sometimes it's 70-30.
Mm-hmm.
It's really what they think is fair, and we have a long conversation about why that is fair, you know, why they think that is fair. So once we get the ratio, we take everything and then we put, you know, start putting things into one column or the other, one person's column or the other. I'm saying one person or the other. You know, I'm not saying husband and wife
mm-hmm.
because sometimes, you know, it'll be same gender
mm-hmm.
couples.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll put the move things over into what makes sense in one person's column or the other. And then once we have everything assigned, we total up the columns. And if they're not quite the ratio that the parties have decided that they want them to be, then we'll go back and we'll look. You know, sometimes it might be that they'll get there by switching maybe like an IRA, you know, a certain amount of money from an IRA or a, you know, a mutual fund or something over, or do a cash payment or do a cash payment over, you know, a period of time. Sometimes it'll be, they'll trade off, you know, one person will say, well, I want to keep my pension, but I know it's worth, you know, X amount of dollars, so I'm going to give you something else to make up. So there's all sorts of trading going around. And what we found is if you look at all of this information in a number of different ways and it all kind of, you know, comes out, you know, with the same result, that helps, you know, people feel more comfortable.
Okay. And I'm wondering, you know, you talk about the pie sometimes comes out in different ways,
mm-hmm.
that it could be 50-50, it could be 70-30.
Mm-hmm.
What happens with you in a situation like, I mean, they have their own understanding of what fair is.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's based on the sum total of the history of their relationship. So what might seem to be kind of imbalanced for you may mm-hmm. seem fine for them. How do you make sure that you're not imposing or injecting your own sense of fairness into that situation?
Well, I encourage them, you know, if we have an agreement in principle, I really encourage them to each check in with their attorney.
Hmm.
So I can't be an advocate for one person or the other, but their attorneys can.
Uh-huh.
And so that's one way of dealing, you know, if it's really imbalanced, it's one way of dealing with it. And the other way is that when I create the narrative, the memorandum of understanding, I put in, you know, how the parties, kind of what they were thinking when they reached this agreement.
Okay.
Like, it's going to be 70-30. These are the reasons why.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important for both of them, for their protection, because, you know, at some point in the future, they may look back and say, you know what, that really wasn't fair.
What was I thinking?
Right.
But then, and well, the memorandum of understanding says what they were thinking.
Exactly.
That's
so
fantastic.
That's important.
That's fantastic. You know, I can imagine that throughout this process, folks develop a relationship with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from my own experience as a mediator that it can be a very cathartic process, a very cathartic experience. I know also sometimes when I tell folks that I do couples mediation as well as divorce mediation, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that too,
mm-hmm.
The difference between mediating people who actually are trying to preserve their relationships, but they'll come back and say, oh, that's wonderful, you do couples therapy. And I have to explain to them that this is not therapy. So tell me about your understanding of this and your experience of folks experiencing a therapeutic aspect, perhaps, to this mediation.
Well, it's been my experience that sometimes it really, once again, it really, the answer is it depends on, on the participant.
Sure.
There have been times when the mediation session has sort of veered over that line, and it's what the participants want or it's what they don't want. And usually they're verbal about, you know what, this is not, I don't want to go there. You know, this is not what I want to talk about. And sometimes they do. Sometimes they need to really go into the past a bit to help them move forward. So once again, it's really, supporting them. The other thing that I do is I have a list of professionals in other areas that I've developed relationships with. And so if they need therapy, then I have a list of people and, what type of insurance they carry and, what their specialty is. I have 3 or 4 providers that really are specialized in working with children, of certain ages.
Mm-hmm.
I have financial people that I never recommend anyone, but I give them the resources. I have, business valuers, give them a list of, 6 names so that they have choices. And the other thing, and this is once again John Haynes coming back to me, is I have books in my office. I have some favorites, but one that I love is by Bruce Fisher, Rebuilding When Your Relationship Ends. It's a classic.
Okay.
I buy used copies and I just give them to my clients because it's such a great book. If they want it, typically one in the relationship will want to read that book and the other one won't. But I have Growing Up with Divorce is another one that I really, I have for folks if they want that one. And that's by Neil Coulter.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Mom's House, Dad's House and Mom's House, Dad's House for Kids. And a new one that I'm in the process of reading right now, I can't remember the title, but it's fabulous. And it's this woman who is interviewing children 20 years after divorce to find out what is their perspective. And what she's found is contrary to Judith Wallerstein's, research, that children are very resilient. They're very they're very resilient and typically can get through, in looking back, they can get through it and look back on it in a positive way. So I think providing, folks with resources is really important. Probably 2 decades ago, without disclosing, the details of too much, I worked with a couple where they had a 3-year-old daughter and the mom was pregnant, and the pregnancy she found out was at risk, and the dad moved across the street with a girlfriend. Both of them in the mediation session decided that, who is their 3-year-old daughter going to be with? Well, they would just ask her and let her decide. And I remember calling John Haynes and saying, John, what would you do in this situation? You don't want to violate your confidentiality. But as a mediator, this is not a good thing. And he said the best thing to do is to give them books and, you know, give them the resources, provide them with that information so that they can see for themselves or refer them to a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think recognizing what our role is and what our role is not is important. You know, when I mediate, I am always very careful never to say, I think you should.
Uh-huh.
I never say, I think, because it's not about me. What I do instead is I float out ideas and options for folks. I say, other people have done this. You know, would this work for you? So for me, it's an art, and it's all about asking the right questions.
Right. Oh, absolutely. It is an art, and knowing what questions to ask is something I think mediators. Last week when I was speaking with Tara, we talked about how much energy is going around inside the mediator. Even if you're sitting there and you're looking very still and very possessed, you know, self-possessed and calm and so forth, inside it's a torrent of thought about what do I ask next and what did that mean and where do we go in this and so forth, and feeling a great deal of responsibility for making sure, you know, not to miss anything or, you know, make sure you're not overstepping mm-hmm. your bounds in the mm-hmm. role. I'm so glad that you mentioned that you avoid saying, I think you should. I hope my friends are listening so that they understand. Because, you know, sometimes I slip into that mm-hmm. outside of the mediation process, and it drives them nuts. I'm like, well, why don't you just tell us what you think already?
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's something that one can come to embody as a mediator,
mm-hmm.
as a way of moving forward. And I think that our friends can benefit from that, actually. You know, having us help them explore their options,
right.
and letting them be the
right.
ones who come to,
mm-hmm.
you know, an understanding of what's best for them rather than us trying to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's an amazing way. What you've described is it's an amazing way of describing what mediators do and what value they bring to a person who, or people, in this case, if we're talking about couples or even groups, who are faced with trying to resolve a dispute. Now, you said that you also work with couples who are not looking to get divorced necessarily, but are looking to preserve their relationship.
Exactly.
And I'm curious about how you do that in light of our conversation about this not being therapy.
Well, the way the approach is really to, once again, help support them in what they want to work on. So they really define the agenda. You know, they define the issues that they may be stuck on, and they define what they want the outcome to be. Sometimes they might want a verbal agreement. Sometimes they might want something in writing that they both sign. Sometimes they might want it in writing, they both sign it, and then they have it notarized. It's really, you know, they define the level that what they're looking for.
What kinds of issues do they bring to you?
Well, it can be issues like who gets to make the decisions, you know, in certain aspects. For example, it can involve how they want to be with one another. You know, what types of processes do they want to set up in terms of how they want to be together? You know, what do they want to create together?
In terms of their marriage, what do they want, or if it's marriage, if it's not a marriage, you know, if it's a long-term
mm-hmm.
relationship,
mm-hmm.
what they want the relationship to mean?
What I help define what they both need and then help them, they tell me how they can best what they need to get that.
Okay.
So in other words, somebody might say, I just really need to feel trusted. So then I would ask, well, if you were to feel trusted, what sorts of things would need to be in place for that trust, for you to feel like you were trusted? So, you know, they end up defining it.
Mm. That's amazing. Oh, how do people then choose mediation for this process over therapy? Do they discuss that with you at all?
Well, part of how do they choose mediation over therapy? Oftentimes they have come from therapy, you know, and they realize that the difference between therapy and what they get in mediation is that in mediation, what they're going to get are some measurable outcomes, you know, that we're going to be able to write it down and we're going to be able to see when it's happening. You know, we're going to have measurable things. And measurableness, often I use that concept to help people kind of get a mental shift. Because oftentimes, whether people are working on their relationship or wanting to unravel, they come in and they're just thinking about what the other person has done wrong, you know, and it was this and this and this and this and this. But what I try to get them to do is a 180 and say, if you were to create your best agreement, what would that look like? And that often, you know, gives people pause because, all right, now they have to stop, you know, itemizing all the, you know, the things about, you know, the bad things and think about, okay, well, what do I need, you know, starting here and moving forward, what do I need that will help, you know, that will make a good agreement, you know, as we move forward.
That's amazing. So the qualitative difference and also quantitative difference that you're finding folks perhaps articulate to your experience is that they can come out with something that is concrete, that is, you know, that is set and that they have negotiated together. I'm curious as to whether you find there to be a gender difference in people feeling comfortable with one process over another. I mean, I know that you don't practice as a therapist, so you might not understand what's going on as far as that's concerned, but it seems to me that this is something that might appeal to men more.
What would appeal to men more?
Mediation instead of going to therapy.
Oh.
I'll tell you, the folks that I talk to about mediation and then, you know, sometimes we get into talk about therapy, you know, I find that often it's the men that I'm talking to who are saying, absolutely not. I will never go to therapy. Therapy, no. You know, we don't do therapy. So that's been my experience, and I'm asking you, you know, based on that. I don't know, perhaps you don't experience that at all.
I not so much. That hasn't been my experience that much, but it's interesting you bring up this idea of gender, because I have seen a trend, you know, in being a mediator over the last, you know, since like 1990. I do have this sort of working idea in my head that sometimes what I see is, and it's hard to generalize, I mean, you know, because people are different, you know, but I think there may be a little bit of a trend for women to maybe give up a little bit more financially, generally, and my working hypothesis about that is that men and women value things differently. So that if a woman were to maybe give up something financially, she has a reason for doing it because she values sometimes not money as much as a relationship, or, you know, sometimes, and that's really, really important to her. And, you know, if her attorney says you're getting a bad deal here, she might say to the attorney, I know it looks like I'm getting a bad deal, but what's really important to me is that my children have a really strong relationship with their dad. That's really important to me, and I'm willing to give up some money in order for that to happen. And you know, when I say this, I will also say that I've seen it work, you know, the other direction where, you know, it might be where the genders are reversed and one person, you know, is willing to walk away with less because of guilt or something like that. But I do have a little, there does seem to be a little bit of a tendency, and I wonder in my mind whether it is just that, you know, men and women value things differently. And another example, and I may have talked with you about this, this was something that happened decades ago, but it was a very acrimonious separation. And the family court judge sent this couple to mediation, and he just wanted them to, they were fighting over 5 albums of photographs.
Oh,
and they were so stuck. They were so stuck, and they just, you know, really were so acrimonious. They brought the albums to the mediation, and because the mediation process really focuses on dignity and respect, and the mediators, I think, are the keepers of that, it was almost like the mediators did not have to be there. They went through the albums one by one. They started talking about, oh, do you remember when we did this? They built a log cabin together. And the interesting thing is the photos that were most important to the mom were the kids' school pictures and, you know, them growing up. The photos that were most important to the dad were the whole process of, like, building the house where they all contributed. And I think that's a good example of, you know, people valuing different things, or, you know, people coming in and they have their positions. I want the photographs. No, I want the photographs. But when you get, you know, underneath it and there's that dignity and respect going on, it turns out there weren't that many photographs that they had to copy that they both wanted because they value different things. They both, you know.
That's amazing. And as you said, it's part of, you know, the nature of the mediation process that would allow for them to have that discovery. You know, I don't know how long they had spent in court being very positional about this, seeing the photo albums as total. You know, you said it's 5 photo albums. And so, you know, seeing them as one unit and not having that opportunity to delve in underneath and discover that it wasn't, you know, one unit, but, you know, 300 photographs, and that when you divided it up like that, then you had some chance for, you know, opportunity for people to be going back and forth and say, no, I really like this. And they're like, oh, go ahead. That's yours. Go ahead. That's fine. Yeah. You know, mediation allows for folks to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's lovely. I've seen it happen myself. So. I'm sitting here reveling in the good feelings of the memories of that. Now, I understand that, you know, as you said, you've been a mediator since the early 90s, since 1990, I think. Did you immediately know that you were a mediator?
It really took a couple of years for me for it to really feel like, wow, you know, this is what I should be doing, you know. And those of us, you know, that are able, passionate about our work, it has a measurable, wonderful, you know, aspects to it. Just to be, you know, to do something, and, you know, people say to me, "Oh, how can you, like, how can you do this?" But you're helping people get to a better place. You know, I you know, another analogy I use is I feel like I'm standing in this muddy stream with folks. You know, we're all mud up to our knees, and I help them. It's hard, but we wade through the mud and we get to the other side, climb the bank, and then, you know, eventually it starts raining and washes all the mud comes out. And that's really, you know, what I think about when I work with folks is you're helping them get to a better place.
Well, understanding it's a process, not an event,
and
that they can work it through, that they really can. Eileen Lee, it's wonderful to have had you here. I'm so grateful for you sharing your background and your knowledge and experiences.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. And I hope someday perhaps you can come back and we can talk more about other things.
I would love that. Thank you.
That's really great. Turns out that Lee and I have a passion in common for sewing and fabric. We'll have to go out and do some fabric shopping at some point. And I want to thank you all for tuning in and joining us here for this conversation about mediation and mediators and the stories from the front lines of mediation. Next week, I am inviting Kenneth Newman to the show, and he is well known in the field of divorce mediation. So this conversation, I guess, is going to continue in a little way. So please go ahead and join us for that Thursday at 7:30 p.m. This show is going to be available for downloading. So if you're listening now, you can feel free to come back to this website and take the link and share it with other folks. We want to have as many people listening as possible and get their involvement as well. I have a couple of other announcements. First, I want to let you know, I happen to sit on the board of directors of the Peace of Heart Choir. It's this wonderful nonprofit organization that was formed after September 11th to bring diverse communities in New York City together through music. And so this coming June 10th, Sunday, June 10th, they're having their spring 2012 fundraising concert. It's called It Takes a Village. And that really is emblematic of what the choir is all about. So the concert is going to be at Hunter College in the North Building. That's the Ida K. Lang Recital Hall, room 424. With the entrance on East 69th Street near Lexington Avenue here in New York City. And I really want to encourage you to come. If you'd like to check out the choir and perhaps purchase tickets, visit the website, www.peaceofheartchoir.com. org, and that's all one word, peaceofheartchoir.org, for more information and to buy your tickets. So I want to do my part for the choir, and I know that you would really enjoy the concert. I've enjoyed many of their concerts myself. So that's one announcement. And the other is, of course, about the music today. I have a special passion for independent musicians and for music that perhaps folks might not be hearing on popular radio. Malika Zahn, who is the artist for today, is one of those musicians. Her name is spelled M-A-L-I-K-A, and her last name is spelled Z-A-R-R-A. So you just Google that or go to iTunes, and her albums are available there. The latest one is called Berber Taxi, and it is available for sale on iTunes. I'm going to play a piece of hers that's called No Borders as we leave the show today. So once again, thank you so much for listening. I hope that you join us again next week. If you have any questions or suggestions, email me at info@123untangled.com, and that's untangled with a D, info@123untangled.com. And you can also visit my blog, which is Untangled Resolutions, one word, untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. All right, folks, have a wonderful rest of your evening and a terrific weekend. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.